Every moment counts. We are the SpyFi guys, and this is The Man Who Saved the World. Hello and welcome back to the SpyFi guys, where we cover spy fact, spy fiction, and everything in between. I'm Zach.
And I'm Christian.
And today, we have returned to a nuclear near-miss movie.
This one's a bit different because, well, not only is it a real-life story, but it's a documentary, which I believe this will be our first documentary.
That's right, but don't run away, audience. Don't run away. It's not like a History Channel documentary where it's really stodgy and dull and has a lot of reused footage from newsreels.
I mean, it does have that.
It does have that, but just a little bit. The movie is set up with two branching narratives. The first is about our hero, Stanislav Petrov, traveling to the United States as an old man. And the second is a flashback using actors about the day that he saved the world.
So have you seen a documentary in this format? Like that sort of thing before where you have the older person sort of telling the story or following his story, and then you have flashbacks to a younger, like an actor portraying a younger version?
I know that I have, but nothing jumps to mind immediately, unless you count Band of Brothers, because that has the interviews with the guys in the beginning and then actors.
Not really.
The rest of the time. Okay.
The only one I can think of is, I think it's called Becoming Bond. It's a George Lazenby documentary, which I think would be fun to cover at some point.
So they have an actor playing George Lazenby in the past.
Yeah.
Oh, that does sound fun.
Mm-hmm. And if you know anything about George Lazenby, he's a bit of a character, so some of his stories are... out there. But let's go back to this movie.
I absolutely can imagine that, right? So last week we did The Sum of All Fears, which was about a terrorist group with unclear motives trying to start a nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Those seem like pretty clear motives.
It's just to blow up everything. This week, though, it's about a near miss caused by an accident and the man who stopped nuclear Armageddon from happening. So here's the IMDb plot summary. Retired Soviet Lieutenant Colonel Stanislav Petrov, who saved the world from World War III, talks about his life as retiree and shares his opinions on the Cold War with actor Kevin Costner in this melancholic mixture of documentary and reenacted footage.
So like almost every movie that deals with potential nuclear war, this starts off with explosions.
Yes, test footage. And very confusingly, the name Stanislav Petrov like appears in text. I guess that's supposed to mean he's acting as himself.
Yeah.
But it was very unclear why the text were there. Yeah. So there was a lot of missiles shooting up too, not just explosions, which reminds you of the Holy Polaris from Batman the movie. And we meet Stanislav as an old crotchety man living alone in his apartment.
He opens a beer, it foams over just to emphasizes how not great his life is right now.
Yeah, I say crotchety because he swears about everything and seems to hate everything.
We hear him listening to an answering machine, all these people asking him for interviews. So, like, I can understand him just being annoyed with all these people just wanting to have a piece of him, basically.
Mm-hmm. And we will be returning to that theme a lot as we go through the movie. So, yeah, he has a Dances with Wolves poster on his wall.
Oh, I didn't catch that. Ah.
Yeah, it's Kevin Costner posing with the Native American guy who I did not recognize.
Yeah.
We also have flashbacks to him having sex with a hot wife.
Mm-hmm.
And then we learn that he's on his way to the United States of America.
So he's agreed to come and tell his story.
Then we get a flashback to Stanislav as a youngish man. I think he's supposed to be in his 30s.
Mm-hmm.
There's news that a South Korean airliner has been shot down. Mm-hmm. And tensions are rising between the United States and the Soviet Union. He has a sick wife named Raya.
Mm-hmm.
Jumping back, he's constantly swearing. A hot blonde woman who's a translator and a journalist come to see him. They're talking to him. He's really crotchety. They bring him his parents and he like loses his shit at them.
Yeah, well, so it starts off, we start talking about like just about when he joined. They're looking at his photos of him as, you know, a young recruit. Find out he was like 17 when he joined the army. And his parents sort of pushed him into it. They basically shoved him aside. And he, like, does not want to talk about it. But this guy, like, this reporter just, like, keeps pushing about it. I'm like, ooh.
Yes, he does.
What? Like, what?
It's incomprehensible. We'll talk about it more, too. So eventually, Stanislav, like, freaks out and yells them to get out of his house.
And like throws them out. Yeah.
Basically, yeah. Great way to start the movie because there's interpersonal conflict. And you're like, what's the deal with this guy? Mm-hmm. And then the text on the screen says, "A true story."
I knew you were going to point that out.
I love the movie pulled its pants down and put its balls right on the table and said, "This is a true story."
Oh.
I love it. And I wish more movies would do that. More news and test footage as we go through the credits.
Including like some news footage of the time in 1983. Apparently there's a World Series going on when this was occurring. Mm-hmm. I guess it's the 83 World Series. I have no idea who was playing though.
Actually, I think it takes place in Baltimore.
I think I said I, didn't
I may be misremembering it, but if it is, that's a weird coincidence.
Right, right. See this other young woman in a car. Who's driving around, her name is Galia. He's like very adamant that he wants to make sure that he's not cheated out of his money, doesn't want to be tricked, and the only reason he's doing this is because they're going to pay him for the documentary, basically.
Yeah, so again, he comes off as very abrasive and difficult to get along with. Also in this part, you can tell they're in Moscow because there's lots of shots of... It's St. Peter's Cathedral, right? The one with all the onion domes?
No. St. Peter's Cathedral is in the Vatican.
What's it called then? Do you know? Let me look it up. I googled Moscow Onion Building. Oh, I think it's called St. Basil's.
Okay.
So I was close.
Sure.
Then there's another flashback, Stanislav on the bus. He has to go to work. He doesn't want to. And there's a fellow Soviet who's basically a warmonger. Is that too harsh to say? He wants to go fight some Americans.
He's just very enthusiastic about the war.
Right.
Yeah. Warmonger is a little strong.
And he calls us crusty Americans. I don't know what that means. Jumping back to the present, they're in New York and they pass by the UN building. And Galia tells Stanislav, "Yo, you have to make a speech." And he gets mad. And I am totally on board with him getting mad.
I like this. Well, first of all, he has a very short fuse, seemingly.
You could say that again.
He's sort of insisting that like he's just a regular person. He's not a politician who can make speeches at the drop of a hat.
Did you know that public speaking is the most common fear, at least among Americans?
I believe you told me that before, yes.
Second only to death. Yeah, there's that comedy bit that if you're at a funeral, you'd rather be in the coffin than making the eulogy. Ha ha ha. It's very old. So the point is, I totally get where he's coming from, where she can't just spring that on him.
Yeah, that's fair.
We had a scene of Galia talking on her phone to her friend. Her friend says, "Why don't you just punch Stanislav when he gets out of line?" I wonder if he watched this movie, and if so, what did he think about that?
I don't know. Yeah, that's a very good question. Who knows? A little behind the scenes, I think this documentary was filmed about 2005 or so, and we'll get to it.
IMDb says it's 2014.
Well, that's when it was released.
But it was filmed earlier.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
There's one thing that's a marker of why, of what when it would be. Petrov is not sure what he's doing there. He's hammering that in that point that if he wasn't getting paid, he'd leave.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes to the UN, and apparently, like, they say that they don't have quite the crowd they were expecting. Apparently, there's some sort of mix-up with badges. I'm like, oh, really? Wow, okay.
It's classic. The scene where he's making the speech is sad because it's just a bunch of bored-looking, like, older people.
Person who's introducing him gives a sort of background to the presentation, which means we get more flashbacks.
Yep.
Petrov arrives at the observation station. People like report into him saying there's no abnormalities, continue with the protocol. You know what this reminded me of?
Is it GoldenEye?
It is GoldenEye.
With the when secret doing bunker?
with the bunker and like they're doing the shift change and all that. Yeah. And that's exactly what it reminded me of.
Yeah. So basically, he reports into work, everything's normal. There's a brief scene where he's speaking English, and I thought he could speak English, but apparently he only learned it phonetically. Jumping back to old Petrov.
Yeah, because he's practicing part of a speech, and he's just saying that, you know, he's not a hero. He was just at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, he says he had doubts that he did the right thing, and that the danger is still there.
Yeah, so he also gets presented with an award at the UN, which is pretty nice. And yes, yeah, so he does his speech in Russian, and then he says his part in English, which has like a nice impact, I think, on the crowd. So he says that, you know, we were basically the closest to catastrophe in 1983, and as long as nukes exist, the possibility of nuclear annihilation is still there.
It's true. The sword of Damocles hangs over us all. We try not to think about it.
Yeah. And so then we get sort of footage of news reports and footage of North Korea is doing this, or Iran might have nuclear weapons by such and such a time. And then they go pretty heavy on the 9/11 footage.
The 9/11 footage I thought was very unnecessary.
Yeah. Like there was a lot like of it.
I did not like it.
Hammering in the point of, because like someone asks him, can you imagine if nukes ended up in the hands of a terrorist? And he's like, I think it's inevitable. And so they're trying to hammer in the, you know, see what they could do with just some planes. What could they do with nuclear arms?
I get that. They just but don't yes, need
no,
to show
I agree it. With you. It was way, they really went heavy on it.
Mm-hmm.
So here we get Petrov meeting a lot of people. Uh-huh. Robert De Niro. He has no idea who Matt Damon is. That made me laugh.
I thought that was weird because I didn't think Matt Damon and Kevin Costner were that displaced in time.
What do you mean? Like, oh, you mean like they look like they do now?
No, I mean, I guess Matt Damon is a little bit younger than Kevin Costner, but it's not like it's Tom Holland versus Kevin Costner, right?
Okay, so how many of the Bourne movies do you think played in Russia, though, or played well?
He does say that Kevin Costner is very popular in Russia, and I suppose Matt Damon isn't, so maybe that explains
that's
it.
That, yeah, but De Niro, apparently, very popular. And so we also get Galia talking on her phone with her friend again, and she's conflicted about him because he's a crotchety old asshole, but he also is the man who saved the world. So he's like an interesting paradox.
Yeah, well, what have you done for me lately, Stanislav? That was 30 years ago. How much longer are you going to keep milking it?
So we get a scene where Galia apparently didn't really know how bad it was in 1983. And like Petrov takes her through it and how, you know, Reagan called, you know, them the evil empire. Talks through how that Korean airliner wandered into Soviet airspace and got shot down by Soviet jets, which heightened all the tensions. And then we go to a flashback at the observation station.
Mm-hmm.
They get an alert that there's a missile incoming.
That's
right. They're trying to get verification. Everything seems to point to an actual launch. Headquarters is waiting for his confirmation before they do anything.
Yeah, it says level of verification maximum.
Yep.
And they say that a lot. Mm-hmm. So it says a missile's coming, but there are guys who are looking for it and they can't see it, but their computers are so shitty that it's like, how would you even know if it's there?
Right. Right.
So I thought this was great, but he says we need visual confirmation before I pass it up the chain.
So headquarters calls him and he answers and says that there is no missile. It was a false alarm. Pretty much instantaneously after he hangs up that phone, there's a second missile alert.
This was my favorite part of the movie.
My God.
This was my favorite part because he calls, he sits down, like leans back, and then the alarm goes off again. It's great timing.
Yeah.
It really makes your like heart sink. It's fantastic.
And then we flash back to present day where Galia is again talking with her friend. Apparently they're going to go meet Kevin Costner. We see that Galia and Petrov are getting along better now. They go and like buy a copy of The Bodyguard.
On VHS, right?
I couldn't tell if it was VHS or DVD. I assume it had to have been DVD by this point.
No, there was, but there were VHSs in the background.
Oh, was it? Okay.
If it was made in 2005, that's kind of the transition period, right?
That's true. That's around that time. They also go to a shooting range where he like shoots at a picture of Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
And like
again.
His first shot is like right between the eyes. Do you see that?
I couldn't really tell, but they said it. So I took their word for it.
Yeah.
But the Osama bin Laden thing is like, again, like 9/11. Again, if it were filmed in 2005, the specter of the looming towers. So I get it. He also uses a Desert Eagle, among other guns.
So they go and visit. Do we know where this site is, where basically there's all these missile launch tubes for the Minuteman II missiles?
I would presume somewhere in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Based on that guy's accent.
Yeah.
Also, like, he has a mole on the side of his face. It's, like, big and red. I don't want to body shame anybody, but it was very distracting.
I did not notice that, so okay. I think they were in South Dakota, which I was wondering, given that he's a Russian, and you know where Russians
in movies
always want to go to?
Montana.
Yeah. It's right next door. I was hoping, it's like, please, go to Montana. Be the one who actually makes it all the way there.
The one in real life.
Yeah.
That would have been great. I didn't even think of that. That's really funny.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's talking to that park ranger who's giving him this whole spiel about basically how effective these weapons are, what would happen with them. And then he makes a comment about how You know, we were just building them for self-defense. And that's what, like, sets him off. He's like, now, what do you think we were doing? We were building them for self-defense, too.
It's something that comes up in the movie a lot. And I wanted to mention this with the whole Reagan evil empire thing. I'll mention it now, that without communication, there's the thing called the security paradox. I think we might have talked about it before, where if you build a nuke to defend yourself, I see that as an aggressive action. Right. So, or like if you put nuclear missiles in Turkey, like a certain someone in a certain other movie that we've covered, 13 Days, check it out, then it gets interpreted as aggressive, even if it's not intended that way. Also, in this conversation, they make the point that like nuclear missiles are like ridiculously powerful. They're like 50 gazillion times more powerful than the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where it's almost like comical.
Every bomb that was exploded in World War II, combine that all together, it's only 60% of one of these Minuteman missiles, which is insane to think about.
Yeah, it's incomprehensible.
But yeah, so he blows up at the Ranger. The Ranger, actually, I was impressed by him that he was like did not try to like argue back with him. He just sort of like took the shouting and then was able to defuse the situation, asked if Petrov, if he thought that atomic bombs would ever be used in war again. And he's like, yes, it's inevitable. The past has taught us nothing.
He has a very nihilistic point of view about humanity and the future.
Yeah.
I guess given everything he's gone through, it's understandable, but...
Also, there's a scene here where he and Galia see a buffalo roam.
A bison, actually.
Oh, is it a bison? Oh.
Yeah, buffalo don't live in the United States. I read that under a misconception list. Yeah.
Then what but that song.
But yeah, the song is wrong.
No! You're blowing my mind here, Zach.
Getting back to the bunker, he says, call the director of the political department, which was interesting because it's like the political officer. He calls his commander, but his commander is like, don't talk to me. Like, leave me alone. I'm hungover. So he just hangs up on him. This is great, too.
Yeah,
it's,
no.
It's like a movie.
Then, of course, after that, there's the third missile. And we get a little, like, slow motion of him, like, going back through the observation center. Say the signals keep coming now. There's a fourth one. There's a fifth one.
Yeah. The first time I watched this movie, I actually thought the world was about to blow up.
Yeah.
That's how much I was sucked in. So everyone's looking at our guy. Everyone's looking at Stanislav. What do we do? What do we do?
He's like imagining all these ICBMs launching. It's weirdly intercut with like the love scene with his wife again.
Yeah, sex and death.
Yeah. Old Petrov is narrating thoughts of how, you know, if he confirmed the attack, there would be retaliation. Lots of people would have died. There would have been complete overkill in the retaliation. So he's like, okay, what do I do? So he keeps trying to get the visual confirmation. Other people are pushing him to make a decision. He says, I'm going to do nothing. I don't trust the computer. I want to wait for radar confirmation. So he orders like everyone back to their stations.
Well, something interesting here that I wanted to talk about. People keep saying we won't have time to retaliate the longer you wait, which is good for screenwriting because it's like a time lock. Like it puts time pressure on him to make a decision. And he says, if I'm wrong, millions die. And I didn't understand this. Now, maybe I wouldn't expect Stanislav to be like an expert on like nuclear theory. But the theory of nuclear war is that weapons are neither offensive or defensive. They are deterrence weapons.
Right.
Okay. Their purpose is to deter the enemy from attacking you, which means if the missiles are in the air, deterrence has already failed. Okay.
Right.
So you have to have your enemy convinced that you will launch if he launches. But if he's launched, there's no point in you launching except to spite him. Because you're going to die either way. Basically, if Stanislav is wrong, then millions of Soviets will die, but not millions of Americans. Is that such a terrible thing? I mean, it is a terrible thing. But from his perspective, they're going to die either way.
But he was not thinking of himself in terms of countries in this moment. I think he was just thinking of just lives in general. And then he doesn't want to, like, if he made that call... And it wasn't like, because he did, like he said, what he said, he didn't trust that computer. And that he, even though they were saying maximum, what was the phrase?
Maximum verification.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, they couldn't see it. So in that case, do you want to be the one who, now it's all on, because you know that he would be a scapegoat if he was wrong.
I think what he's going for is that if he loses his nerve, millions will die. So maybe I choose to interpret his comment that way. Maybe there is some translation error.
He like debates changing his orders and actually following the protocol, but he realizes, no, I'm not going to do that. And in minutes, he says that in minutes they'd appear on the screen and minutes later they would detonate. And so we get 30 seconds until they're actually going to be observable. get the countdown, and then when they are observable, radar finds nothing. So everyone celebrates because they avoided World War III.
That's right. What a relief. The longest 30 seconds of his life. There's a quote here where someone says, "We showed those Americans."
I was like,
what are you talking about?
Show them? You mean, is that the same guy? Like the very gung-ho?
Oh, it could be. I don't know. I wasn't paying
attention for that, yeah. But what was really interesting to me is the fact that they couldn't find what caused this glitch. You're telling him, you know, make room for a new medal on your uniform. And so he goes up to see the commander general, who is not happy with him and says that, you know, there are gaps in the combat journal. You know, well, I chose to lead my men and not keep my journal. So I said, well, why didn't you go back and fill it in afterwards? And I was like, because that would be altering a military document, which is illegal.
It's classic Soviet. They're just out to get you.
Yeah. Yeah. So they make him a scapegoat. And, you know, Gauya, in the present day, asks, is this why you left the army? And we find out, no, the main reason he actually left the army is because his wife's health was rapidly declining. Her cancer was very advanced. The classic, the doctor says there's nothing we can do except make her comfortable.
The system wrote her off, is what. He says, there's also a part, I don't know if this was intentional, but the actor playing Stanislav seems to have less hair. Like the edges of his hair, and he has like a bit of a bald spot. I liked that. He actually looked worse than her. She was the one who was dying.
He's taking care of her, and at a certain point, he falls asleep, wakes up, and finds that his wife has died in their bed.
He says, "Forgive me," which I guess is like, "Forgive me for not being there when you died." Mm-hmm. This movie has too much emotion. It made me feel too much.
You
turn into spy movies to feel. So it gets worse too.
Yeah, and Gauya, you know, asked if he, you know, ever loved anyone after her. He says he didn't even really try anything after her. He was all by himself. Apparently his mother came the day after the funeral and then left shortly after that. And he hasn't seen her since. And his family, you know, doesn't really know about what he did.
That's true. Well, he wasn't allowed to tell them at first. True, but even in 2005, they don't know.
Yeah.
He was just like, why tell her? What's the point? She's the way she always is.
Yeah.
Eventually, though, they finally meet Kevin Costner.
Yeah, so they go to his trailer, and it is super nice inside. Like, it looks like just a house. It's got, like, wood paneling and everything inside his trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Costner is actually apparently surprised that he wanted to meet him. But we find, Petrov, like you said, is a big fan because we saw the post in his apartment.
Yep.
And like we said before, apparently Kevin Costner is very popular in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Petrov gives him a book on Moscow.
Yeah, it's like a coffee table book.
There's a funny bit about how he tried to send it to his, like, to Costner's house. And, like, his publicist had to explain why he can't send stuff to a celebrity's house.
Yeah, I know they don't go into it, but I would have liked to know why he would have thought Kevin Costner would want a book about Moscow.
I think it's more just bringing something as a gift.
That's fair.
And that's, like, his home, you know, so he wants to share his home.
Yeah, but unfortunately, this whole scene after that is terrible. Because he tells Kevin Costner about how dangerous nuclear war is. And I'm like, we just went over that a half an hour ago.
Costner asks. Yes. He's the one who asks how many lives would have been lost. We find that apparently would have been half the U.S. population after the first strike. And all communications roads would be destroyed, and it would be the same in the USSR. There'd be a chance of a second strike.
So there's a little bit more information this time.
Yeah, there's a little bit more. It gives, like, rather than just saying, you know, that it would be terrible, we get you get not exact numbers, but rough figures, which gives you a better idea. There's also intercut here, Petrov looking at houses from, like, a nuclear test site. Mm-hmm. So he, like, gets to see the actual, you know, impact of what would have happened to half of the country if he had made the wrong call.
Yeah, I guess I was wrong when I said a lot of that test footage is from the Soviet Union. I guess some of it is probably from America as well. Yeah. Watching Costner's reactions to the speech is kind of interesting. Like, he seems like he's trying to seem very serious. But you could also tell, like, he has no idea what Stanislav is talking about. It's like his tiny actor. And I like Kevin Costner, but, like, like, big intellectuals, okay?
I mean, he played JFK.
Yeah, we made fun of him a lot for that.
Oh, no, he didn't play JFK. He played the other guy.
He played Kenny, yeah.
Yeah.
Like I said, I like Kevin Costner, and I especially like seeing him, like, not being an actor in this movie. I think he's pretty likable, but yeah, it's like nuclear war is not something he understands a lot about. That's pretty clear.
And I think he knows that he does. So he's just trying to, I think that's probably why he was asking these questions, so he could better comprehend the gravity of what Petrov did.
But like I said, I feel like you could have cut the scene where he's talking to Galia and just put it all in here.
No, because then you couldn't do the flashback. That's why you have that as a framing device, is so that he's telling her, so then he's reliving it. Like, you wouldn't have him reliving it with Kevin Costner.
Well, unfortunately, because it's a documentary, you can't just cut scenes up like that.
Oh, no, yeah.
Because if he didn't talk to Kevin Costner about that stuff, then you can't put it in. Mm-hmm. But I will say, though, that once the flashback's over, I feel like a lot of the tension goes out of the movie. Because he's explaining the death. I feel like that would have been better if it had happened before the crisis was averted.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of just too... hammer home the impact of what he did, basically. So there's a nice scene where Costner brings Petrov onto the set of the movie that he's filming, which is apparently The Guardian.
Not in 2014.
2005.
Yeah.
That's why I think it, that's, as I said, I'd come back to that. That's why I think, because did you notice who else was on set?
I saw a guy who I thought was Adam Baldwin, but I think he was just a tech guy. And I did see my favorite actor, Neil McDonough. There you go.
Also, Ashton Kutcher.
Yeah, he shows up in the credits. Yeah. Or is he in this scene? Is he in this the special?
He's in that scene as well, I think, but I didn't notice him until later on.
Missed him, but they talk here. I don't remember who says it, whether it's Costner or Stanislav, but he says, "We must forget the past and move forward." But that contradicts what he said earlier about how we didn't learn from the past. So what do you want saying from us, Stanislav? What do you want from
he
us?
He doesn't believe that we have, but we need to.
I guess they're really not contradicting.
Costner, gives that whole speech and announces who he was and that he's a hero, brings out the champagne.
Yeah.
And then we get this interesting thing of, all right, Costner asks Petrov, I think they're having dinner together because they're having a meal together. If he was king of the world, how would he fix everything? And this is where Petrov says that, we must forget about the past. The country, our countries must get along, basically. And the next scene, we start in an exterior and we just hear Galia and Petrov fighting.
Actually, before that, there's a brief part where she's sleeping on his shoulder.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, they're fighting again about the mom. I'm like, Jesus Christ, you guys need to let the mom thing go already. Holy shit.
So, this one, I feel like, though, Galia is actually doing it for his own good, not like journalist who was just trying to get information, really, and just trying to get a reaction.
It's true, but he has such the reaction. It's like, Galia, respect the guy's boundaries. Come on.
I mean, on the other hand, it's, she brings it up that he's old, so his mother's older, and that she won't be around much longer, so you gotta heal those wounds before you don't have that chance.
So I did this to a mutual friend of ours who I won't name.
Okay.
But he was like, my mom's coming to visit this weekend. Ugh, she kind of gets on my nerves sometimes. And I'm like, hang in there. She's not going to be around forever, so try to enjoy your time together. And he just turns and looks at me and he's like, that was low. Sorry, buddy. Jewish guilt. It's in the blood.
Oh,
I'm susceptible to it, too.
She continues to push the issue, and he's not having it. He's saying, this is my personal life. This is not a... And she throws back, you can talk to Costner about world peace, but you can't talk about your own mother. And you're just saying to him about how you have to forget the past and forgive, and yet you can't forgive your mother. And he blows up, storms out of the hotel.
What a mess.
And then we see him going on a plane back to Moscow. He's back in his apartment. He unpacks his award from the UN.
Yeah.
Goes to a graveyard, puts some flowers on his wife's grave.
Mm-hmm.
Some indeterminate time later, we don't know how long, he calls Galia on the phone, and she's annoyed with him, why are you calling? I'm very busy. What do you want? And he's things are not great. My brother died 2 days ago. She asks, did you see your mother? He's like, no, I haven't seen her in a long time.
The mother again. See what I mean?
I mean, okay, at this point, I think it's the movie shifted tone in from what he did into just how he wants to live the rest of his life.
I don't know how I feel about it. Because on the one hand, it's a really good character arc for him. It's really emotional. Too much feelings. My little heart couldn't take it. But on the other hand, it's really frustrating to see people keep bringing up the mother and having him blow up at them. And then they just bring her up again. It's like,
Fair, well, in this situation, though, when she brings it up and she pushes him to go see her, she knows that he's going to argue. So I was like, I'm not going to argue with it. I just think this is what you need to do. She knows him by now and knows that he's going to start arguing. So she like basically just cuts him off, says, I'm not going to argue with you. This is what you need to do. And when they hang up, it's actually on good terms, like take care of yourself, that sort of stuff. So it's not.
Yeah.
I think it actually worked that she was breaking down this barrier. She knew how far to push.
She's basically like, you know, I'm right, but I'm not going to argue about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he gets on a train and he goes to like, looks like a slum almost. And he does find his mom.
Yeah.
And she immediately lays on the guilt trap.
Yeah. She's super dramatic. To be fair, like her other son had just died.
Yes. I wondered if this might be why they had such a strained relationship. Because there are some people, fortunately, you see them in fiction. I don't know anyone in real life like this. But there's an example is the play and then the shitty movie, August Osage County. And also The Sopranos, but there's older people in it who will like manipulate their children by guilt tripping them like this. And I'm not talking Jewish guilt. I'm talking like extreme. Uh-huh. And they're basically like toxic, like narcissist personalities. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's what the movie is saying about his mom, but there's the potential. Like that may be why the relationship is what it is. Mm-hmm. Like she hasn't seen him in like 30 years and immediately like starts slamming him with that. It was hard to watch. Stuff with old people, I like can't handle it.
Brought her and like, oh, you know, I haven't seen flowers in a long time. So I think they just needed to get that out of the way and then the healing can start.
Yeah, I think someone says, I can't be mad at you. And then they share some pictures together. Yeah.
He forgets Matt Damon's name. I thought it was hilarious.
Oh, I forgot that part, so.
But they also go to visit his brother's grave, and yeah.
Mm.
The movie ends, but we have some stuff during the credits. We have, this was... threw me off. Like there was a Marilyn Monroe impersonator who comes and into his room. And
okay, the whole stuff with the mom was very, like I said, it really made me sad, but it was also a little hopeful. It was very emotional. And then it cuts to what looks like a stripper, possibly like an attractive woman dressed up as Marilyn Monroe doing like a song and dance routine for Stanislav. And it was very strange. It was a very strange choice.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why that was in there.
Especially because it's not clear like why she's there or who hired her. Like maybe at the end she could have a car that's like from your friend Kevin Costner.
Which would also be weird. But yeah, at least we have a little explanation. But yes, we get a little more like just shots of him meeting various people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is where we see Ashton Kutcher, who is sitting like a few seats down from him. I think when they're doing the filming, he gets up and just like goes and wants to shake his hand.
It's funny seeing Ashton Kutcher on the other side of that exchange. Because I think that's happened to him a lot. Because you can see him like working up the courage to say something or deciding whether or not to say hi. So there's a part where Stanislav is looking at a U.S. Army recruitment ad, Army One, which I don't think they use anymore.
I think that was in, well, again, that's because I think this was, like, that was around the same time that they had in 2005. I think that was in Times Square as well.
Yes, it was. I also remember it was a news story when they switched from Be All You Can Be to an Army of One.
Really?
They used Be All You Can Be for a long time.
That's right. Yeah.
And then the last note I have for the credits is they're in a diner and there's a waitress. And Galia says to her, this guy saved the world. And the waitress says, oh, that's cool. I can tell she's been doing this for a while. She probably hears all sorts of wacky stories.
But yeah, with that and the movie does finally come to an end.
I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it, but first we have a little spy fact versus fiction. This is all from Wikipedia about Stanislav.
Okay.
He had a son, Dmitri, and a daughter, Yelena.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the movie didn't mention them. I wanted to know what the deal with them was.
Also, he estranged from them as well?
Yeah. Also, those are the most Russian names in history. Just putting that out there.
Dmitri, Yelena. I mean, Natasha's up there too.
Yeah. His wife, Raya, died in 1997.
Oh, okay.
So Stanislav left the military in 1984, 1 year after the incident. By choice, he was not forced out, though he was sent to a less sensitive post after being reprimanded for the log. He then later got a job at the Research Institute, which developed the early warning system.
Oh.
I guess he's an expert on it, so it makes sense.
Yeah.
He then retired so he could take care of his wife. A BBC report in 1998 said he had suffered a mental breakdown and quoted him as saying, I was made a scapegoat. So I suspect the mental breakdown is why he couldn't get along with other people.
Right. Yeah.
So he later says that the influence on his decision was that he had been told the U.S. strike would be all out, not one missile, two missile. It would be like 100.
Right.
That also occurred to me. He also knew that the launch detection system was new. And he also thought it went through to maximum verification a little fast.
Yeah, that's fair.
But in a 2013 interview, he said he was never completely sure that his call was correct. But he did say that he felt his colleagues were all professional soldiers with pure military training. They would have immediately reported it because that's what the military does. As opposed to him who worked in the civilian world a little bit first. So good thing that it was him and not a military guy.
Right. What if whoever was supposed to actually be on duty didn't get sick?
That's true. So the same day that Petrov was first honored, the UN ambassador to Russia said, "Hey guys, the system required multiple confirmations before we launched. We were not within one phone call of like blowing up the world." That's a paraphrase. And then finally, Stanislav died on 19 May 2017 from hypostatic pneumonia. On 29 September 2018, he was posthumously awarded a Future of Life Award worth $50,000. His daughter collected it on his behalf, but his son Dmitry missed the ceremony because the U.S. embassy delayed his visa.
Oh, do we know what happened to Galia?
I did not look her up.
Okay, I'm just curious. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. The fact that they came to collect his money made me wonder if it was like a Gran Torino kind of situation where they like didn't care about him until like they could make money off of him. But that's super depressing to think about, so I'm not going to. Have you seen Gran Torino?
I have not, no.
It's a great movie. There is anti-Asian racism in it, though, so I can see why you wouldn't want to see it.
Yeah, no thanks.
But it is really good. Okay, so now it is time for our favorite quotes. Would you like to go first? Because I have quite a few.
I'll go first. One that, I don't know if it's a favorite quote, but it got me. It's like, it's a terrible thing. The torture of loneliness.
Whoa, I don't remember that. Was that in the movie?
Yeah, it's when he's basically, it's like when he's after his wife's died and Galia's asking if you ever loved again and all that sort of stuff.
Holy cow.
That got me. Let's see. Nobody will win in a worldwide nuclear war. We have to learn to coexist as brothers or perish like dinosaurs.
Yeah, I like the dinosaurs one.
Finally, from Kevin Costner, what's Makba? When he's trying to read the Cyrillic and it looks like Makba, but no, it says Moskva.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Okay, I've got a few. When he says, I'm not some slimy politician who can blab away at all times. I'm a regular person. So I don't know if that was meant to be like a thing, but yes, he is a regular person. And that's what's so amazing about it. Towards the end, he says, these women will be my undoing. Stanislav is so quotable. Kevin Costner says, in my country, it's easy to be famous for the wrong thing. How true that is. And then finally, my favorite quote, the one that has stuck with me, even though I watched this movie a long time ago, that I tried to make a history meme out of it, but I could never make it work. Okay. I don't trust the computer. I think that's a great line.
Yeah,
I think it's really badass. All right, so now it is time for our ratings on a scale of 1 to 10 martinis, 1 being The Avengers 1997, 10 being even better than No Time to Die. I am really curious to know how you will rate The Man Who Saved the World. That being said, I can go first.
Yeah, go. Why don't you go first?
So I've actually seen this movie 3 times. The first time, I thought it was great. I thought it was really gripping. Loved the badass one-liner. The second time I watched it, I thought it was terribly boring.
All right.
So now that I am watching it for this, really locked in, I think it was pretty good. Like I said, repeating the stakes was a bit much. 9/11 footage was also a bit much, but it gave me a lot of feelings. And I thought Stanislav was a really interesting guy to follow around. And I learned a lot. I thought the flashback was really good. So I am going to give it a 7 out of 10.
All right. Yeah.
I should add, though, if you want to watch it, it would probably help if you're really interested in these issues. Like, if if you don't care about, like, nuclear war or the Cold War, you're probably going to find it pretty boring.
You know, it held my interest, but it was a little lacking in the spy action that I was looking for. Like, yes, they're preventing World War III. You know, we get a little bit of, like, what their capabilities were of like, all right, this is how we detect and everything like that. But there wasn't a lot of spy action in it for me. That's being said, it was still a very good movie. So I'm going to give it a 6 out of 10.
Nice. I feel like it's kind of like 13 Days, where you have people who have to make decisions based on limited information and they have to make gutsy calls.
And what's the common denominator?
Nuclear war?
No. Well, Kevin also Costner. Yes, but Kevin Costner.
Very nice.
Well, thank you for joining us as always. You can find us on social media on the Spy-Fi Guys on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, I'm Christian.
And I'm Zach.
And we are the Spy-Fi Guys, signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Spy-Fi Guys. If you enjoyed our podcast, please be sure to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. The theme song from this podcast is Mistake the Getaway by Kevin McLeod from Incompetech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. Films, books, and television shows reviewed by our podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
This is a personal podcast. Any views, statements, or opinions expressed in this podcast are personal and belong solely to the participants. They do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the participants may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated. Any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.
You can find our podcast on social media at The Spy-Fi Guys on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.